Artist Friends Podcast.
Hi, I'm Diane Hunt. I am an impressionist realist painter connecting with nature through my brush. I work in oil paint and watercolor, and I live in the countryside of Maryland's Eastern Shore, not far from the Chesapeake Bay. You can find me online at dianehuntstudio.com. and on Facebook and Instagram at Diane Hunt Studio.
Hi, I'm Constance Brosnan of Steve Brosnan's Jewelry Designs. I live in Oklahoma on a prairie, and I make handmade jewelry in silver, copper, and brass. I'm an artist that paints. I paint pastels and in oil sometimes.
Hello, this is Bob J. Gale. I'm the host of this podcast. I am a emerging representational artist. I do historic renderings, seascapes, landscapes, botanicals, birds, and whatnot. The tight illustrative hand in watercolor, pen and ink, and acrylic paints. And I live in Oklahoma City. And here we are once again. It is Monday, November the 22nd, 2021. My name is Clyde J. Gale, and you are listening to the Artist Friends Podcast, episode 124. And I'm here with my two best artist friends, Diane Hunt, Constance Brosnan. Hello, Diane.
Hi, Clyde. Hi, Constance. Hello, everyone.
Hello, Constance.
Hi, Clyde. Hi, Diane. Hello, everybody.
Welcome to the podcast. And for this week, we are going to finish up our art history and three colors discussion, the BBC series that was in three episodes, about an hour for each episode. The last one, the colors were gold, blue, and white. And the last one for this week is the color white. And if our listeners go to www.talkartpodcast.com, that's talkartpodcast.com, they'll see the link to the video. And we'll, you know, take a look at that, and you'd be surprised. It was very well done. And how the color white changed eventually, its meaning. We'll start off with Diane. What impressed you with the video? Did you learn something new, and did the video impress you?
Yeah, I didn't know some of the stuff they talked about as far as white, kind of the whitewashing of Europe, trying to make everybody, like white dominant or whatever. I didn't really know about that. I mean, I kind of knew like Mussolini and Hitler and stuff. They wanted the Aryan nation kind of thing, but I didn't really know how extensive it was as far as all the artwork and the buildings and things. It was kind of crazy.
Yep.
I was surprised that he didn't talk more about pigment, like the white pigments in paint.
Oh,
he was talking mostly about marble and white buildings and that side of it. Especially since he was in England, because I know in Queen Elizabeth's time, they think that she went crazy because she was using the white, lead white in her makeup to keep her skin looking white, because that was it was fashionable at the time when she was around, that women had really white, pure, clean skin, and not touched by the sun kind of thing. And the lead, they used lead in their makeup to keep them for their skin, and they all started getting lead poisoning. I guess they didn't realize that's what was happening, but at the time. But I was surprised he didn't talk about that since he was in England, you know, BBC was in England. But
he may not have been allowed to talk about it.
Maybe.
There was quite a bit. I mean, you could really expand that subject of, you know.
Yeah.
So but I like the progression, how, you know, he started off with, and I know Constance, before we started the recording, she happened to mention, and I'll let her take it off. What did he start off with those Greek statues?
I mean, and that was in England too. What was the man's name? Let me look.
I don't recall.
Finkelman?
No,
yeah.
Later.
It was the scrubbing of the sculptures, the Greek sculptures that they had. He found all of these sculptures that were just, he thought that they were dirty, but they weren't dirty. They were painted at one time after they were carved, and the paint had just gotten old. So he wanted to, he's had them scrubbed down to the marble base.
Yeah.
Which messed up the actual sculpture itself. But and then when later on, when someone else figured out what they were doing, they made them stop.
Yeah, you know, British Museum,
because they were destroying the actual sculpture itself, and also, you know, the integrity of the sculpture was being destroyed. But also, you know, they were taking the layer of paint off that they were actually painted at the time after they were finished. At the time that they were done, they were painted. And so.
And then this was what, in the 1700s, you know, I guess when they were doing that. And then later on, a guy by the name of Finkelman, who was just infatuated with, you know, the white sculptures and the white statues, and you know, he went to Rome, was made the director of the Vatican Museum, and he contributed to making the classical, the art of the ancient art of the classic period, that it was something of the purest form of expression, and it was something that was considered grandiose and marvelous. And in fact, his writings contributed to museums and collectors in the early 1800s. Yeah, you know, and that I didn't know about this guy at all until I heard it in the video, and I thought, okay, that made sense. Then we moved into, I think they moved in. They talked about Wedgwood.
Mm-hmm.
Wedgwood, you know, pottery was in England, and he was fascinated and influenced by Finkelman. This was
about making the white glaze for the pottery.
Exactly. And I thought that was rather interesting, because I'd heard, everybody knows, even people who are not familiar with art, you mentioned Wedgwood, and everybody knows what that is.
Right. I have a little small piece of a little small dish that's Wedgwood, and it has that classic, it's blue with a classic white, you know, decoration on it. And
now what you buy.
I did not realize that was actual pottery. I thought, well, I knew it was pottery, but I didn't realize that the white was a white glaze that was on there. I thought it was just white pottery that was put on top of there, like china. You know, they just put a piece of china on it. I didn't realize it was actual glaze that was on there.
Before Wedgwood's experiments, you know, that didn't exist. So I found all this, you know, rather interesting. Then we get to the guy. I bet Diane knows what I'm thinking. We get to the guy, we're up into the, you know, mid latter part of 1800s, and we get to the guy called James T. Whistler.
He was full of himself.
Several months ago, when we watched a video about Duchamp, and I immediately, you know, attributed Duchamp, you know, he started the modern art movement. Well, now It's Whistler. I've changed Whistler, but from Whistler, from Whistler. For our listeners, Whistler was basically, he was a spoiled American rich brat who went to England and was very snobbish. And, in fact, the thing that I picked up, I didn't know at the time until I watched this video, other than, yeah, he was fascinated with white, you know, and he later on that became kind of like his trademark. But the one thing that he started that to this day is still done, and it's because of him, is the layout of galleries and art museums. The wide open spaces and the wide, the sterile, you know, white walls, you know, and the gray floor, concrete floors. He, before galleries, I guess, weren't like that. And he that was his contribution. Now, not all, but a lot of galleries and museums, they do that. And what is interesting is they're not very welcome. You know, they don't really welcome you. And there's no seats, no benches, no place to sit down. In fact, what was so funny, after I watched this video, I looked at my Instagram and there was a post from the critic, Jerry Saltz, who was complaining. He made a little note complaining. He says, gallery owners, would you please put some benches so old folks like us can sit and enjoy the art? And it was so.
I really think that there should be a places to sit in front of artwork, because you want to sit down and enjoy a piece, exactly. You know, or maybe even sit down and do sketches from pieces, you know.
To this day, that open style, not all, but a good percentage of museums and galleries right here in Oklahoma City. Several years ago, when a local artist from our class, you know, when Mark invited me for a day out, and we went and had lunch, and then we went to the Oklahoma City Museum of Art. Now, I enjoyed looking at the artwork, but I did not feel welcome in that museum, and I have not gone back since then. When you first walk in to get to where the galleries are at, you have to go up this super long, large staircase, wide staircase. By the time you got to the top, you were halfway wore out, and then you had to walk through all of the various galleries. No, not a single bench anywhere. We went through six different galleries. We was in there for an hour, and the only reason why we didn't stay long, he wanted to stay longer, but I was getting wore out. My feet were killing me.
Now that's a shoe thing. You need to do something else about your shoes.
I almost fell down the stairs going down the stairs because I was felt like lead. I was so tired. And I was polite to Mark and everybody, but I said, no, I told myself I will never come back to that gallery because I did not feel, you know, I've been to different galleries and museums that has had, you know, benches and where you could sit, you know, like I spent when I was younger, I've been to the Chicago Art Museum several times, and except for in their small galleries, but in their large galleries, they have benches where you can sit and look at the art and admire, study the art. They've got, you know, chairs, you know, located out. Now the small ones, cause there's just not enough room in the smaller ones, but in the larger ones, there's benches there, you know. It was a pleasure. I remember spending hours and hours going around that art museum, you know, enjoying myself. And I kind of, when I went to this museum, I'm thinking, okay, no. And now, retrospect, looking back, thinking back after watching this video, I can blame it on Whistler.
Yeah, you can, I guess.
What do you think about Whistler?
Yeah, he was a little arrogant. Full of himself, yeah. But, you know, he did. I think having them spaced out like that, you can enjoy one piece of art before you move on to the next one. But having windows in between each one and all that kind of stuff, I don't know that that's really good. I like having, you can have them next to each other, you know, and you can enjoy one and then move on to the next one, because you have the lighting right and everything. But I do believe that they should have benches where you can sit. If you like a piece, you can sit there and look at it, you know, if you want to study it for a while.
Exactly.
Because a lot of people just look at them, but there's a lot of artists who like to sit and study a piece.
And, you know, it's just, you know, it's more of an inviting, you know, experience, you know, and everything. Mm-hmm. Diane, what did you think about Whistler?
Yeah, I didn't realize he had anything to do with how the galleries are set up today.
Yeah, I didn't either.
I was surprised by that. But, yeah, it is kind of like he was, I mean, he kind of was snubbing his nose at the, you know, at the elite and stuff. But at the same time, doing something like that, it made it so the norm, like regular people, didn't feel comfortable going into a gallery. So in a way, he kind of did the opposite. So yeah. I don't know. It's kind of strange.
Yeah, he was snubbing. Well, he was snubbing his nose at the Victorian period art, because the tradesmen and working class liked a particular style of art, you know, during the Victorian period. And that's what he was snubbing his nose at. And I love where they use an example. His museum was set up where they had the guards museum. Sir, please do not allow your clothes to drip on the floor. Then a little bit later he says, no hats to be worn in the museum. And then finally he says, the museum is closing. Get out and don't come back.
Well, I think it was his way of making a name for himself, and he did really well at doing that. I mean, you know, some artists, that's just how they do to make a name for themselves. You know, every artist who has made a name for himself has done it in a certain way. You know, Duchamp in his urinal sitting there with his, you know, signed name to it. I mean, certain artists, that's how they've made a name for themselves, by being who they are, you know.
Yeah, but they
eccentric. You know, so he was eccentric, and that's how he made a name for himself.
He purposefully, only his select group were elitists. I mean, he intentionally, you know, we're only smart enough to figure out the art, you know. In fact, that's why he was a big contributor to the, you know, modern art. And that's how a lot of the modern art has always come across to me, as being very elitist, very snobbish, and, you know, very unwelcoming.
They also gave us, isn't he the one who gave us Whistler's mother? Or is that another artist?
That's another one.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. This is James. Yeah. They call him James T. Whistler, I think is his name.
Okay.
But I think you're thinking of Homer Whistler.
Okay. Well, I wonder why they didn't bring that up.
But, this fellow, I mean, he, has, and the thing about how he played in with the story of White is that there was a story that was written that all of London was infatuated with the lady in white, you know, and he immediately, you know, he did start doing paintings of women dressed in white, you know, and it became a bit of a mystery. They couldn't figure out, you know, what he was.
He never did tell anybody who the people were or why he painted those.
They probably were. It was his way of.
Yeah, he just called
eccentric.
Symphony in White number 3, something like that, you know. But then when he, you know, gained a little more notoriety and had some money, he opened up his, you know, his gallery. All the frames were custom built white frames on white walls, spaced all the way out, you know, and that was a major sensation, you know. He specifically discouraged the working class and tradesmen from, you know, it was designed only for the educated elite, his circle, you know, and that's all that he, you know, wanted to appeal to, you know, and so that kind of like set the trend. But then he became infatuated, you know, with White. So as further to, and it's all about being snobbish and sticking it to the British public. He, you know, he started wearing white clothes. He actually had a little tuft of white hair on the top of his head, you know, And then he built a house all white, and he called it the White House. And when he would go out walking with, he had two white poodles. I mean, it was really off.
Well, it's like I said, eccentric. It worked for him.
So then this takes us up to, there was some French architect.
Mm-hmm. Boucher?
Something like that. I'm not even pronounce the words.
Ripplin?
Yeah, he came up with the paint, the color Ripplin. Tell us about that.
I had never heard about that. So
me either. He wanted everything to be painted with Ripplin.
Yeah. Just a white paint, but he named it.
Mm-hmm. Bare walls with white paint everywhere.
Yep.
He built a house. Somebody commissioned him to build a house, and it was all painted with Ripplin inside and out. And then they put a bathroom sink right in the hallway as you come in the door. The owners were not happy about it. I don't think I'd be happy about that either. Too. Huh?
It took them 3 years to build it, but they had given carte blanche to do whatever he wanted. So it's like,
imagine
the kind of money that took, because it was a huge house.
Yeah.
And then not to look at it at all until he was finished with it.
No, I would not be happy.
What I like how the video.
I've built houses and I have had hands on the whole way through. I would not be happy about not being able to see a house. I've designed the house, I would not be happy about having a house built and not be able to have my hands on it while it was being built.
But what?
And he had the ramps that went through the house rather than stairs, and they were rather steep ramps. It was all about, staying youthful and being in shape and exercise and stuff.
Yeah, he was a big health.
Yeah. And then they're not supposed to put any artwork or anything up in the house. It's like, so all you can do is look at white walls and outside the windows. It's like, well, I don't think so.
But I like the way the video, when they started, white was considered something to be of purity and unique and
clean.
And then it went into this almost sterile, stereotype environment. And then what Diane alluded to when we started our discussion, it got over to during the World War II, the fascists and
Mussolini.
And it actually turned into, being white. It was white, but it actually was dark, the starkness and the more of a fascist control. Diane, tell us about some of that.
Well, Mussolini, he commissioned artists to create buildings that were basically sterile white buildings. And he did do a couple things. That one stadium was kind of cool. He had a different, it was an athletic stadium, and he had a different sculpture from each area of Italy. And it was made from the marble from that from that area.
Yeah, the Carrara.
They each depicted, a different sport. So that was kind of nice. But he commissioned this big, the Carrara marble. He wanted to do a obelisk.
Yeah.
And he commissioned them to bring out the hugest piece they could find. I forget how many tons they said it was, but they had oxen pulling it out.
It took 30 oxen to pull it through the town.
30 teams of oxen. And it still stands today, which is kind of weird, that they didn't destroy it when he lost power, but it's so big.
When I lived over in Italy, some of those structures, I don't recall seeing the stadium or the building, but I do recall the obelisk. And I did go see that, and I was just amazed that it still had his name on it, that the Italians hadn't.
It is part of history. I mean, this.
So with what's going on in the United States, if it was in the United States, it had done been torn down.
Well, at least yeah, that's one thing I don't understand. And I'm,
yeah,
I don't want to
at least think they would have taken his name off of it, you know?
Yeah.
But I don't know.
Yeah, but his name
is part of history.
His name is,
even though it's bad history, a part of their bad past. Maybe it's a good reminder of how things, they want things to go in the future.
He was a construction, you know, nut, because like, okay, I lived over in the Naples area, and there is a street in the suburb of what's called Fuertegrotta, of you know, just. And there's a street called Via Augusto. And on Via Augusto, the first time I saw this, I could not believe it. You know, there were palm trees all up and down Via Augusto to this day. Those palm trees were Mussolini, when they attacked Libya in Africa, they brought them, he imported them from Libya and planted them. And all over Naples, there's palm trees everywhere. And they unless they just completely, you know, fall apart, which most of them don't, but to this day, they're thriving and they're considered like a national treasure, you know, but they are there, remnant of when Mussolini, you know, was in.
Well, he had also started that in that marshland area. He had set up the whole city that he wanted to build, and some of those buildings are still standing today. It's kind of crazy.
I've never seen them, but they were, yeah. Yeah, they were there. His, a lot of his structures are over. The main post office in Naples, Italy, when you first go in, it's a big, giant lobby. And when you first go in, there is this giant bronze statue of like a woman with a spear. She's on a horse that looks like the Pegasus horse from, you know, mythology. That's Mussolini's. Yeah, he did that. He put that there. And so the Italians hadn't, you know, sure, they got rid of him and got rid of his policies, but they kept his art. You know, they kept all
the. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of hard to get rid of something that beautiful, even though they got rid of him, you know, because
you know,
some of that stuff is really stunning. You know, it's hard to get rid of the beautiful work that he had put up. You know,
so there's he's, you know, all over Italy.
It's like in the South, they're getting rid of all those great old statues. I mean, and they're putting them away. It's like, why don't you bring them up? I'll put them out here on my ranch. I mean, you know, it's part of history. I mean, I hate for them to get rid of history. You know, I know it's bad history, but it is history, you know.
But getting back to our discussion of white, I really liked the way we started out. It was pure and clean, and then it became sterile. And then after sterile, it became oppressive, you know, because Mussolini in the fascist period, they use it as a more or less an oppressive that, you know, it was pure, just, you know, the Aryan white race. And all the statues are all, you know, that kind of a, the poses with the muscles and the, you know, and Germany, Hitler did the same thing. In fact, Hitler was a protege of Mussolini. He admired Mussolini. And so he did the same thing. The only thing is during World War II, Germany was bombed so much that a lot of it was just a lot of that stuff destroyed, yeah, and you know, we didn't bomb Italy as much as we did Germany. So a lot of this, you know, you can still find little remnants here and there, but they're not, you know, not anything like during the 30s what was actually built, you know, and everything. But that kind of, you know, impressed me. It was a good. I didn't realize that white had that much of an influence, because I don't think of white as a color, you know. I never think of white as really as a color, you know. It's it's something to add color to get a hue, yeah. But it had a definite you know, influence, you know, throughout history.
Yeah, even in this country, white is used in certain ways, with certain groups that I won't bring up that's bad, you know, so.
But then again, you have like the white wedding dresses and it's like purity and, you know, innocence.
Yeah, and hope.
So and you have, you know, multiple meanings for the same color.
Yeah.
And it's kind of different.
It has lots of different, people use it for lots of different.
Yeah, but that, you know, it was a good, it was an interesting history how, you know, it, you know, influenced, you know, art history. What I enjoyed the most was the Wedgwood discussion. I really, because I have seen, I mean, I'll spot a wedge. I like pottery and I'll spot a Wedgwood miles away, a Wedgwood style. It may not be an original because now you, an original Wedgwood, those are collector's items. They are very expensive.
You know, I went to a group, went to a thing one weekend, and they had this little table, and ladies were selling stuff. And I spotted this little piece of Wedgwood, and it was like dirt cheap. And I could not believe it. I turned it upside down and looked at it, and it said Wedgwood on the bottom. It was really a real piece of Wedgwood. I snapped it up so fast it wasn't even funny. But I could not believe, you know,
yep,
that it was sitting there. And I said, oh, this is destiny. I bought it.
You buy, you know, so-called Wedgwood style or Wedgwood china, but it's not the original Wedgwood. It's you know, it's
yeah, this is just a little trinket dish, you know, so I snapped it up.
I thought it was really interesting how many variations he tried to get.
Yeah, he worked for a long time to get that glaze.
400 and some different. Pride or something, wasn't it?
Yeah, like 111, 112, something like that.
He was determined to get that glaze the color he wanted, and it was a matte glaze that he was after too, not a high polished glaze, you know, and it's really pretty.
But all of his pottery followed, he was like I said, heavily influenced by that fellow by the name of Winkel, and the classic, you know, the classic style. But the coloring was the white with the decoration, you know, and it's like, you know, just extremely fascinating. So did you guys enjoy the video?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like the whole series. It was interesting.
So
learn some new
things. discover stuff you didn't know about.
So then I have a vote that the last three episodes was 100% was a A-okay, huh? Right?
Yeah.
Yes.
It's interesting.
Okay. Let's wrap this up. For our listeners, if you go to www.talkartpodcast.com, talkartpodcast.com, you'll see the video, what we're talking about. And if you scroll down, you can see the links to the previous videos. And I recommend watch the series and, you'd be surprised how just three colors changed the art history, changed the world. Yeah, three colors. Sometimes for positive, sometimes for negative. And it was a very fascinating and informative series. Now, before we go, before we wrap this up, I want to wish all of our listeners a happy Thanksgiving because this week is Thanksgiving. And I'm going to wish Diane and Constance a happy Thanksgiving. Say goodbye to you both. Let Diane say goodbye to everybody.
Bye, Clyde. Bye, Constance. Bye, everyone. Happy Thanksgiving to all.
Goodbye, Clyde. Good night, Diane. Happy Thanksgiving. And thanks for listening.
Yes, thank you so much for listening. And enjoy if you can be with family. That's great. And if you can't, and just enjoy that turkey. I know I'm going to, because I got a turkey this year. Ha, ha, ha. We were talking about it before we started the recording up. Bye, folks. Until next time.
The Artist Friends Podcast is produced and edited by Clyde J. Kale. Participating artists, Diane Hunt, Constance Bronson, and Clyde J. Kim. You can find more information about Diane Hunt at www.dianehuntstudio.com.
Constance Bronson at www.etsy.com/shop/CBROSNANS. Clyde J. Kale at www.cjkaleartworks.com. If you would like to participate or appear as a guest on the Artist Friends podcast, please email cjkale@mystery-otr.com. If you enjoy these podcasts, please give us a thumbs up or a star rating, and most of all, send us your comments. This podcast is issued under the Creative Commons license.